Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
There has to be a game plan. Like, all the healthcare organizations this week are getting together talking about how do we 100%, you know, block what could potentially happen? It's how are we prepared for when it happens?
Yeah, what happens after?
To be able to get back online.
Right. It's not, resetting the expectation inside the organization and across the industry that it is going to happen. If somebody wants it bad enough, it's going to happen.
Right.
But the key piece is, once it does happen, how do you respond to it? How quickly, how well, how comprehensively, how prepared you are to confine, to eradicate and recover. And that will define how the rest of your organization, how your customers, if that's the type of organization that you are, and the world sees you in the light after the incident.
Right. And the article you sent across this morning, though, Brian, I think took it a step further, and it's saying ransomware was more starting to cover up data exfiltration, right? That ransomware was a component. I'm going to lock it in place. Okay, pay me some money. I'll give you the key. I'll unlock it. And now we're starting to see, okay, you need to pay me to unlock it, but I also have a copy of it sitting over here. And I've said it for a while now that I think ransomware at some point, much like DDoS has becomes a smokescreen. Because it's so prevalent, and then what you see it start to happen. Oh shoot, my files are locking. You start getting, the help desk is getting calls and all of that. It's a big event that all of a sudden all eyes go on that event. But what's really happening? What's the magician, the hand doing over here?
I absolutely agree, and that's why one of the reasons why I shared that too. I was just sitting up reading, and I was like, oh, this is super relevant to what we were talking about. You know, everyone when someone says, oh, I was hit with ransomware, but I'm not worried about it, I backed up all my data, right? So yeah, you had your data all backed up, so you weren't worried about, in essence, I was shut down for a few days. How do I get back up online? Dan, to your point, when it comes to healthcare, though, the idea of getting back up online has to happen relatively very quick. I listened to a really interesting story out at GERCON that was shared by Spectrum Health, and it's one of those, when they were telling the story, it really hit home, because I was sitting back going, I hope this isn't a joke. I hope this is being serious. Because he starts out and says, imagine that you have a child, right, that has this condition, right? And you know that this is happening, or he's having a stroke, or he's having this, and there's a golden hour, right? You call, the ambulance comes, you rush him to the hospital, it goes through the timeline, and they get there, and with 5 minutes left in the golden hour, the hospital is hit. They can't do the scan on the brain, which is the only definitive thing to tell them what's going on. They call in a helicopter to medvac them. You're at the 2 minute golden hour, right? Like, you know, you're not going to make it. As a parent, you're sitting there. And I was like, and they said, they're like, this was an actual situation that happened. Luckily, we were able to get back up online, but it taught us a very, very serious lesson, right? And you lead with something like that, and it's very strong. It's very personable. Like, that hits home. So when an organization says, well, we backed up our data. Okay, you might have backed up your data, right? But how much data was actually exfiltrated, though? How many copies were actually going to be made? You look at, I think it was over 120 million euros have been paid out as GDPR fines in this year. 120 million euros. And that's only going to go up. Talking to the insurance agencies, they're not even budgeting in terms of when they budget next year's number. That today's number times X, they're like, we don't even think that's enough going into next year.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. The question's been asked, and we kind of covered it last week a little bit. Why do we do what we do? You know, as you look back over the last 10 episodes, that's why. Because security is no longer just a check the box something. All right, you know, to be a business, we've got to do this bare minimum. The stakes are so much higher, and they continue to grow every day. And the impact, I mean, just looking at the ransomware, it's interesting looking at the evolution of it as well, that you go from, you know, harkening back to just locking files to now the complexity of some of the ransomware strains that understand retention periods on backups. These things are living in your backups until they realize, oh, you keep them for 1 year. Okay, 1 year plus 1 day is when I'm going to show myself. And then all of a sudden, it's sitting on every incremental backup that you did. And that's got to fundamentally change our strategy and have a conversation. So it's got to be business focus. It's understanding what is important. If it's data, then you have a secondary method to back up. You know, for instance, if it's SQL, right? It's an out-of-band SQL backup, just the data that, as far as I know, no ransomware strains are living as objects in SQL databases and stuff like that. So it's really morphing and changing our conversations on how we change our strategies to combat the evolution of these things.
Yeah, I think the 3-2-1 backup rule is gonna need some evolution. Well, it's always been, it's been good to date. You know, the idea of having three copies of your data, one primary and two backups, having copies in at least two different types of storage media, and one of them being offsite. The problem is we started to trade redundancy for backup, and there's all of this live real-time syncing and real-time backup. And it means that you inject something at the front and it will propagate all the way through. Oftentimes we see it it's very efficient. It happens almost instantaneously. That's great when you want recovery, but it's not great when you've injected corruption and you've now started to affect the integrity portion of the security triad.
Right.
I see some changes forthcoming. I couldn't tell you what they are yet though, because I think that this is such an evolving space.
Going completely esoteric. So are you saying that replication is not DR? Is that the news headline here?
I know this may be shocking to some, and cloud and SaaS services that you use that have high availability. If somebody starts to corrupt it, you're going to have highly available corrupted data. But yeah, DR is not, redundancy is not recovery. Redundancy is not backup. I asked somebody once about how do you back up your Salesforce data? And there are third-party products to do it, but 95% of people, and that's a number I made up, but yeah, no source on that. But the vast majority of people I've spoken to have never thought about how they would back up their Microsoft Office data, their Teams data, which they're using for critical files, their Salesforce data. Those are the kind of things that they need, they need to be thinking about. But like you said, Eric, it's moved beyond just let me take your backup and hold your data for ransom. It's now about disclosure.
Yeah.
You know, people are doing better at backups. Very good for us. Guess what? Now we have a new threat. And it's the disclosure of that data. And then this leads into, they've wandered into a place where many organizations are fearful because data, both from a financial impact, a regulatory financial impact, as well as a reputational impact, is one that is far more business aligned. And now you have non-technology people looking in at this and going, this is going to impact our brand. This is going to impact our ability to sell. It's going to impact our regulatory ability to operate maybe in certain regions. So should we do whatever it takes to pay and make this not happen?
Right.
Let me throw something out to you. 5G. You hear it talked about a lot.
Buzzword.
5G. 5G.
Edge compute.
So, you 5G. And I know I've heard a lot of presentations. I've seen some telecoms get up and present. Some autos get up and present how this is going to change. You know, autonomous driving. How it's going to change this. How it's going to change that. I haven't seen anybody get up on stage and talk about how 5G is going to change security, because what you guys were just talking about, if there's this 3-2-1 policy of storing data, and now it's about data exfiltration, and you're able to download something at speeds of X, where now you can do that across the board. If you actually see data being downloaded, large amounts that now look very similar to other things being done in the environment, it's kind of difficult to pick up on how fast this is being copied and shipped out.
Oh yeah, the bandwidth problem is now multiplied. The needle in the haystack problem is multiplied based on much more available bandwidth at every edge point. You have so much more hay to find the needles when you're doing those kind of analytics.
Right. Well, if you did it as a metric, I mean, speed to full compromise is going to be that much quicker now, right? Because that data, I can get out so much. It's the same thing that as all of us moved online to whether it be Google, Office 365 and those things, right? You know, you go back, you used to have file servers on-prem. Well, to get to a file server, you had to go through a firewall to get to somebody's computer to jump to those things, the hoops. There's multiple layers, right? You move all that data into Office 365, I need an account. So I can pop that account and I've got the data right away.
And it's the same thing. So you're fine.
Yeah. Well, that incrementally does get better, but I think 5G speeds that up even further. And as you start getting into edge compute and looking at that in the context of the IoT environment, right? As we look at IoT devices, there has been a very big lack of attention to security around those devices. It's all about speed to the market so I can get it out there. And the impact, I don't care. We'll deal with the impact to security down the road. I think it exacerbates that as we go to edge compute and speeds it up, that the barrier to entry to create those devices to get them operable.
Give a few examples of IoT devices for some of the listeners that maybe just hear IoT device and don't understand all the different IoT devices that are around. Give some examples of those.
I mean, an IoT device could be a thermostat. It could be a camera. It could be a sensor. It's one of those
using inside their homes, right?
Or absolutely. Inside their cars, or inside their, or inside their phone. I mean, there's everything that is.
So if connected. You're working from home and you're on your own network, not VPN'd in, and I mean, I'm just throwing out scenario after scenario after scenario, because there are more and more and more people working from home and not everybody is VPN. You could make a rule, Eric or Dan, that, well, in order to work, you have to be VPN'd in. It's like, well, if I'm not actually looking at this file, or I don't have to save this on the company file, or if I don't need to look this up, I don't need to VPN in. And right. Then I'll just continue to work on the things that I have and just keep saving them to my desktop because it's easier.
Right.
But I want to go back on that though, because I think, Eric, I have a slightly different perception of,
sure.
of 5G. I think the greater risk of 5G is a privacy risk and not necessarily as much a security risk. Bandwidth has and will continue to be widely available to those who need it or want it. The average Starbucks, the average, you know, wide open internet is there. That mm-hmm. connectivity is there. Can I do it while I'm mobile, while I'm in the car? I can already buy a hotspot on 4G LTE for my insert, you know, big three car here if I want to pay whatever per month for it, or my phone already has it. 5G is, you know, 5G brings with it lower latency, higher connectivity, and is going to be leveraged more by always on devices. Not necessarily those that are being used to being actively used as exploiters. The 5G connection will be leveraged. And by the way, none of this is realized yet because 5G is in its infancy. The first phones are about a year or two out. Despite what you may read or see in the ads, Apple is not the first to 5G. They're just the latest. Android's had this for quite some time.
And good luck finding actual 5G around you as well.
Right. And there, yeah,
even though we're claiming the network's 5G right now.
5G is a marketing term. There's different bandwidths. In the US, it's extra complicated because of the way the frequencies are allocated.
So 5G, will it cook my popcorn at the same time I'm talking on the phone? I've heard all these horror stories.
Only if you put the popcorn in your ear. No, sorry. That was, if I were Twitter, I'd have to put a disclaimer under my comment, false and misleading comment, purely jokingly. No, 5G does not have, I mean, it's no different than any other signal strength that's out there. The 5G millimeter wave, the high 5G that is in the US only has really high frequency and therefore very short, short distances. And only available outside. I think in the US, it's only being used at the moment by AT&T and Verizon. And you have 500 feet between towers. So the problem there is you have a lot of towers to make it happen. So you do see more waves, but it's not
the antenna density is huge.
Right. It's not anything different. But I think the bigger challenge with all of this connectivity is the desire and intent to suck up as much flow of data from IoT devices for legitimate and quasi legitimate purposes, that's where we're going to see where 5G poses, in my mind, a bigger challenge. If you want the connectivity, you've already got it. Yes, will it make it lower latency? Sure. Will it make it more available while you move? Maybe. I can get just about anything I need from anywhere I am today with a phone and connectivity at pretty good speeds, unless I'm out in the middle of, you know, the middle of the country with absolutely no, you know, nothing in sight. So I think the challenge on 5G is way more data collection, privacy. What are people doing? Just because you can have a big stream of data coming from every car, thermostat, PlayStation, about every button push and every, you know, rotation of the wheel one way or the other while playing Forza, those kind of things are going to be where 5G really, really pushes the envelope when it's.
I can see that. And I think there's also on the technical side, there's an element of moving from wired line to wireless, right? The security controls around wireless have evolved over time. You know, as we look at the evolution of the different encryption levels and things that you can run on access points to help ensure, you know, as you get into 802.1x and all of those things, sorry to get too technical on that, but that's evolved over time. But now taking the idea of IoT, whereby security wasn't a thought in building it, it was more about getting to market. I think we're going to start seeing that built into the wireless chips that are in those devices. So as you say, more and more devices are coming out. I think the propensity to be able to man in the middle, step inside the stream and understand what's going on, that's always been there, but not as many devices are running 4G. And I think as more run to 5G, that if I have a wired line, I'm just traversing a single wire, right? It's directional, and you would have to splice into it, or you have to be somewhere upstream in one of the hardware devices that are routing that traffic. But wireless is not, it's kind of all over, right? You can kind of jump into it, you can start reading it. I think we're gonna have a problem with some of the security controls that are written into the wireless spectrum to be able to encrypt the data that allows me as somebody that's just sitting in maybe a park or somewhere around a building to have greater insight into what's going on with devices.
Yeah. And I think I want to turn that back on itself too. Yeah. The one thing I didn't account for in my rant a minute ago was the fact that all these devices that are going to be permanently connected are now also susceptible to being ransomed. Now my car, my thermostat. Oh, you want it to be 62 degrees in your house? Guess what? Pay me $1 million or you can't change your thermostat. And 95% of people, again, a made up number, won't know how to go down and
60% of the time it works every time.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that is that always on connectivity and not necessarily done in a way that is protected, blocked, or even audited by the average person. Now we have to put our confidence in the device manufacturers themselves, that they're putting and maintaining security. And I guess we're already some years from the insight that cameras, that there's a big distinct difference. And I'll see if I can find the research, big distinct difference on cameras that are higher price and cameras that are low cost and their maintenance. I mean, I think it seems pretty straightforward to all of us it makes sense to all of us as we think about it, the three of us, but you know, people see a $20 security camera that they can put on, but without and they go, that's great. I get great functionality, but not realizing that it may already be susceptible to attack and compromise, and will likely not be patched because the manufacturer put it out there low cost and isn't maintaining it. There is definitely a cost to maintaining.
And I don't want to go down the path of what we were discussing before about cost of building products and so forth. But you make a great point there. When you talk about firmware updates and everything else, you know, you're paying for what you get. So if you want something really cheap that's really susceptible, boom, there you go.
But you think in those terms. We all think in those terms, though. Where I still struggle is, how does that get conveyed to the end, the normal consumer?
Right. Well, now it's getting conveyed in the form of subscription services for absolutely everything you buy. Yeah. And we're close to a revolt where people are looking at their finances in times of hard financial times, which we are in and are likely only going to get worse over the coming years. And say, I'm paying $30 a month for this. I'm paying $6 a month for this. And Netflix just went up by $1. And, you know, all of these things, and they start to look at what they're going to pay for and not pay for. And some may have service that goes away if you don't pay, but some may keep some service but not allow support. Wow, that killed
them. I thought I still had my microphone on. I would totally agree with that perspective, because, I mean, when I first saw Netflix and watched it, I was like, man, there's only like 3 movies on here I like. I would never pay this. And I was one of those guys that was like, I would short them. There's no way that a company like this will continue. Fast forward 3 years later, I don't have cable and all we use is Netflix, right? And the stock price has done what it's done. And this is totally unsecurity related. There's an app called Tavor, which allows you to order custom IPAs from across the country. In the first week I had the app, every time I hit like, yes, I like this, 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 I didn't realize I had built a box of like 56 IPAs. Right, I spent more in 1 week than I had in a year.
So, and every one of them was good, though, wasn't it?
Amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is a great app. But so, yes, I get that. I got that same thing that when I first got the app, it's like, oh, this beer sounds good. Oh, this beer, and then Jen, hey, how many beers did you buy when that box finally came in? Oh, oops, because it's so easy to just click a pallet.
You know. Yeah. They're like scheduling it. We have a pallet we need to deliver.
It's like the in-app purchase for adults.
Right. It's same thing with Amazon. I know we were just talking about the idea of connected devices, what Amazon was trying to do with the idea of Sidewalk, but also look what Amazon's already done with the idea of being able to order, right? I go in and you, like when COVID started, the quarantine started, all those things that I had set, you know, for these are like the 10 things that I get every month, because these are the consumables that I know we go through. And some of those started to not be available, and you switch to this size or that size, et cetera. And before you know it, fast forward a year and you're still getting stuff. And for maybe 2 or 3 months, I probably should have stopped getting this, but I just didn't take the time to do it. Mm-hmm. So what did I do? I overconsume. I overspent. I have a plethora of fig bars for the next year, right, that the family has to eat, just because I didn't take the time to go in and turn something off. That's just one example. All the different apps that people are using, that when you draw on tough times, nope, I got to go ahead. I don't need this. I don't need this. I don't need this. And it goes back to that the old saying of your parents' luxuries become your necessities. When your parents had a black and white TV growing up, right, that became a necessity. That was a luxury then. It was a necessity to have a color TV, just one in the house. Now it's like, if you don't have a flat screen TV in every room, right? Like, geez, like it was like the old, a luxury of having one vehicle for the family. It's like, well, you only have one car in the family. Why not 2 or 3? Like those luxuries becoming necessities. And then I also think back to one other saying when we were talking about 5G and the idea of sharpening a knife. So you say, how can I get through cutting all these onions, all these peppers, everything faster? Well, if the knife was sharper, I could get through it that much faster. So you sharpen and you sharpen and you sharpen that knife and get it as sharp as you can. But this time when you make a mistake, it's not just a little cut, you go all the way to the bone.
Deep.
And I leave you with that.
That's awfully deep for this early in the
morning. Yeah, that was pun intended.
Ouch.
No. Oh. Too early in the morning for me to think like that. Yeah. Good call.
Brian pulled a mid-session mic drop there. That was good. I mean,
very apropos.
So being the pessimist, is there any hope for the proliferation of IoT devices that they get any better from a security standpoint? I mean, Brian, you're talking about that all of a sudden things become necessities, right? And as you, a lot of the things that you listed are devices that are all connected now, right? And as we look at buying patterns, there's this intersection of, I want a good price, but I want something that's decent, right? And how do we correlate the two together? Well, it's stars on Amazon, that I want something that's got 5-star ratings, and I want the most people that have already rated it, that has nothing to do with security. Nothing. People have
or even the actual quality of the product, as we've now 100%. Found out from various investigations into how stars are applied.
But oh, that's crazy. That's crazy, actually, going through the stories where you've got fake accounts that have been opened up to just to do reviews for their products. And yeah, that's,
by the way,
there was a name coined for that now.
If you're ever feeling bad, go read some reviews. I recommend sugar-free Haribo gummy bears. Read the reviews. They'll make you laugh.
That's fantastic.
It begs the question, does it get any better? I mean, if the average consumer doesn't care and we're just worried about the intersection of price and functionality, is there an opportunity? Is there a place that, you know, you think about it, to spin the analogy of the knife, right? The knife in the context of this could be legislation, right? Legislation could start cutting into this and start forcing the hand that, hey, here's the barrier to entry. You have to be this tall to ride. Here's the framework. Here are the things that you have to build in. But I don't see that happening. I don't think there's enough concern around it. And I feel there should be, but I don't see it changing.
And you make a great point there. The one thing I worry about legislation, once you get politics involved, the companies that have a lot of money will continue to go and spend and lobby for laws and rules to be put together and bent True. In favor of some of the larger companies. One thing I will say, and I come from a company that sells, you know, security as a service, but when you look at the IoT devices, and to Eric, to your point, if the consumer demanded that there be better security, but no, the consumer doesn't really understand it today. But the other part to that is, the more you make these devices vulnerable, the more products companies like the one I work for just keep coming up with more solutions, charging the enterprises more, which is at the end of the day built into their total cost structure. So as their cost goes up, they're actually trimming down the fat to say, well, if we don't need to do this, don't need to do this. At the end of the day, here's our go-to-market price. So the cost to do these things gets removed. And at the end of the day, we just keep coming up with more products to try to protect the enterprises and supposedly the people, right? But at some point, that cost has to become an issue to say, we should be building some of this stuff in ahead of time, doing our root cause analysis, our deep dive, our 5-why, et cetera, to have some of this stuff built in, or at least a framework or an idea, right, that everybody's kind of building around or to. I don't know, discussion?
I think that there's also a layer in this, which is the race to the bottom on cost. People go, yeah, we're at that time of year. We're recording this on the cusp of November. What are we seeing? Low-cost stuff, Black Friday stuff, consumerism at its best in this country. And people will go for the low-cost item with the functionality. We already saw, I think it was probably around a year ago, the CEO of Vizio made the comment about how they price their televisions. It's built in that they want them low so people will buy it. And they price in data collection as part of it. So it's not just low cost to build, low cost to maintain. It's also artificially offset by other means to make sure it gets into people's hands. Although one could argue that kind of a continuous stream may encourage them to keep it patched and updated so that they can continue to get the data streams that they're after. But the race to the bottom on cost, buying at the $20 item, people don't realize what that might mean down the road for availability of patches, for availability of, you know, security. They're putting this inside their network. And what is that actually doing, either intentionally or unintentionally, leaving open for somebody to come find? I mean, we talked about Shodan on a few different episodes, previous episodes, but that is just the tool of all tools to go and find all of the cameras that people have put out there that are unpatched and barking to the internet saying, please come spy on me.
So bringing that back around then, so you have all these devices out there that we just talked about, IoT devices, there's this cost to get to the bottom level cost that people will buy. If you're somebody sitting back there, and we use the term threat actor, right? If you're a threat actor sitting out there and you're involved in the business of ransomware, because it is a business. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you got to be saying 5G, yay, more IoT devices, yay, push to the bottom end of cost, remove this, yeah. Like you couldn't line up more like underhand pitches for these guys to come after. Is that correct?
100%. Yeah.
So when you got like my family, my dad say, well, Brian, why are these people doing that? And I'm like, well, Dad, why do you guys keep buying these different devices? And why do you send me emails with attachments of things that you don't know what it is all the time? Just because one of your old fraternity brothers, who also was going through college at the time when there wasn't an internet, thinks these pictures are funny, but there's nobody that's ever checked them. The worst thing I can get is an email from my father with an attachment in it. I just don't open it. I do not. I love you, Dad, but I don't. And I hope you're listening.
Well, I'm 24 hours from having had to do family phishing remediation. So that one hurts even more. Extended family.
It's tough because you have these corporations. And when I say corporations, I'm talking about the ransomware corporations. Yeah. All right. When I say ransomware, these threat actors, these are organized crime and very organized. All right. The type of stuff that's out there, like ransom as a service, right? You have help desk, right? You have people that can really help point you in the right direction if you want to get involved in this really bad, if you want to call it crime, because it is. But we're not helping ourselves, whether it's, you know, through the education process. And what I mean by that is I'm not talking about just businesses educating their employer or their employees. I'm talking about while you're in school, right? Learning certain aspects of the internet, right? How it works when you're online, what's going on within a network, right? What things you should be very careful of and why, right? Like, why are these guys out here doing this? It's a business and they're after money. Yep. At the end of the day, they're after money. Why does somebody break your window and rob you? Right? Like steal a purse out of the back of the car, right? Or pop a trunk to see what's in the back of it. They're trying to steal something. And if you can do that without having to go up and physically punch out the lock or break the window, now you can do that from a computer. It's very similar, except in this case, they used to lock up the computer. Now what we were talking about is the idea of it's not just locking up the computer because people have all these backups. They have their data available. It's about exporting that data out. Thoughts?
Yeah. So just as a quick follow on, recently in the last couple of days, the last couple of weeks, the US government has come out with guidance that says if you pay ransoms, you are you may be potentially funding terrorism. That's always been the mindset of, you know, doing this by paying, you're perpetuating the habit. If they know that they can get money this way, they're gonna keep doing it. But now have layered on this new addition of, if you do this and it turns out you're paying to an organization that truly is about terrorism or is located in one of the countries that's forbidden for U.S. people to be able to interact with or give funds to, Iran, North Korea, others, that you may actually be held accountable under U.S. law. And the question came to mind, you know, when you're, Brian, in your example, when you're in the alley and somebody comes up to you and they hold a gun or a perceived gun up to you and says, give me your money, what's the advice we give them?
Give them your money.
Give them your money. Right. But in ransomware, what's the advice we give them? Don't pay.
Well, don't pay.
Don't pay. Well, I'm going to ask this question real quick. And what's the first thing you do when you've been hit with ransomware?
Call your insurance company.
Oh. Well, the government would say you're supposed to contact the first thing you do in terms of reporting is contact the FBI. And when I tell friends or even family that, they're like, why is that? I'm like, you got to understand you're paying somebody that's outside of the state, et cetera. There's also, from a federal standpoint, it has to be reported. Now, my understanding is one of the reasons that the government put out the warning that if you facilitate a payment, right, like, you could be held accountable is that, so people are making sure that they're reporting, you know, in the first 24 hours when they get hit, because some people were not reporting. And Eric, share your thoughts on that.
So it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it in that, in those terms. I think that makes sense. I disagree with it. And this, and you know, I'll go tangential here too. And I'd be interested in how you guys view the topic of hackback, right? Because I think that one was hotly debated. And you know, my view on that is, we were told, no, you can't hack back, you can't fight back. And now we're being told, now you can't pay the ransom. And I feel like in all aspects, we're finding different ways to neuter companies' ability to respond to these things, that you're essentially a boxer in the ring and told, you're just going to stand there and take the punches. Don't throw anything back, just take it. I don't think that's a good approach.
Sorry. I was actually having that discussion on that topic the other week, earlier this week, the question of do we fight back when these things happen? And the business perception was, we should do that. We should defend ourselves. But this was with the CIO, and the CIO, this discussion happened between the CIO and his or her executive. And the CIO said, no, that's not what we do. Because the ramifications of doing so, I think, not knowing your enemy. When you're in a boxing match, you know the enemy. You know who it is that's standing across from you. You know what Mike Tyson is capable of when you're standing in the ring with him.
Or you was just capable. Triggered Art of War. And Sir Brian, here we go.
Of course. And so therefore, you know how to respond. We don't know. There's so much we don't know about the attackers that we know some of the style, we know what they're showing, but we don't know what's behind the scenes. And attacking back can bring a heck of a different response, and potentially coordinated across groups, across organizations, across nation states. And then you have to ask, it's a risk question. Once again, as always, the answer is, it depends. You know, do you want to fight back and potentially risk a pretty hefty response? Or do you want to take I hesitate to use the word more civilized approach, but not come to their level and deal with it, manage it, prepare for it, respond and isolate? Because at the end of the day, if you fight back, what are you getting? You feel good. You feel better. When you punch the bully on the playground, you feel better. And then he turns around and starts pummeling you, and you say, was my one punch worth it? I don't know.
So interesting analogy.
I do agree with that, but I will say, so what just happened this last week with the announcement from the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, mm-hmm. with the alert, the AA20-302A, for those that are listening, that was a warning going out to all of our healthcare and public health sector about an ongoing ransomware activity, all right, targeting 400 or more very large institutions. And you ask yourself, why? Why would that happen? And it's understood that it's Ryuk TrickBot, which also would encompass Conti, all right? And these names that we're throwing out there are threat actors or groups. Ryuk is a ransomware group. TrickBot is a group out of Eastern Europe. Conti is kind of the blending of those two together, pulling in some Russian organized cyber figures along with some Eastern European figures, and they're attacking healthcare. Why? And a lot of people believe it's a response to what the US government tried doing a month ago in utilizing some of Microsoft as well to go after TrickBot to disable them before the elections. So you walked up, you flicked him in the ear, and you thought you got him good. And he turned around and he's now punching you in the face. That's what happens when you mess with a bully and you flick him in the ear. He punches you in the face.
I like your analogy way better than mine, Brian.
I was thinking about that too, like as I'm doing it, like nobody can see me on video right now. And I'm like, I remember what that felt like when someone just went boom right in my ear, right?
Does that mean you were the bully?
No, that was my brother constantly picking on me, like coming up from behind, right? And finally, one day I did turn around and I did tackle him, but I still got beat up.
I mean, the bully analogy, I get it, but in the context of the election and everything, that doesn't that presuppose that they weren't going to punch you in the face anyways? And I feel like that was coming no matter what. So if that's coming no matter what, let's play ball. Let's see what we can do. Let's throw some punches.
You're taking the greater good mindset versus the if I don't punch him, maybe he'll punch that company or that organization instead mindset, which
is noble. So I'm playing it from the government standpoint.
What you're saying is the bully already said he was going to meet me out on the playground and beat me up on Thursday. He said he was going to be there. So in essence, what you're saying is let's cut him off in the hallway, slam him up against the lockers on Tuesday, hopefully
send a message,
the fight on Thursday, only for him to show up bigger, badder, and stronger on Thursday. And now I'm outside. I'm like, where are all my
of his friends?
Right. I'm like, where's all my buddies that help slam him into a locker? Right. I totally understand what you're saying. I think this is probably a great debate because people could go back and forth on this. Well, yeah, you fight back. You fight back. Do you? And I'm kind of to the notion of I would love to see people fight back. Should it be the enterprises and organizations? I mean, here's again, personal opinion, just throwing this out there. In a lot of the last wars that we were in, during the progression of those wars, we would hire outside agencies to come in to work as third parties to handle some of the grueling grunt work or some of the things that maybe you need to keep your hands off of.
Right.
Why not? I feel I'm spinning something.
Your middleman discussion takes me exactly where I think I wanted to go next anyway, which is to what extent do we push this off? You say, you know what? I'm too clean for this. Insurance company or negotiated middleman, go take care of this. I pay you. Go take care of this. This is white collar. You know, this is the white collar mindset of you've attacked me. I'm going to hire somebody who's going to come and either attack you, negotiate with you, make a settlement. You know, this is the US. It's all about settlements, right? And for those, just to some background on this, there's an increasing trend. You know, we've had cybersecurity insurance for quite some time. It's growing in use. It's growing in coverage. It's maturing as a field. You know, there's better
actuarial
tables.
Growing in cost.
Well, yes. Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, because there's better actuarial tables, they have a better handle on what these kinds of things cost. And the sheer increase, as we talked about at the top of the show, the sheer increase in the number of these incidents and the predictability and the volume of what they're going to cost. And the insurance companies now will have, there's entire industries that have cropped up of people who are just doing this middle person discussion, to have the discussion between the organization and the hacking groups to say, all right, you asked for 12 million, we'll give you 550,000. There's a chat with one of the somebody who had been compromised. There's a posted chat. One of the BBC had come out with finding some of it, and you actually see the interaction between this middle person and the hacking organization, and it felt very much like buying a used car. Well, I'm going to ask for this, but my manager's not going to like it. From the hacking organization saying, you know, this is the number and you know, I'll ask, but it's not going to like it. And they come back with another number, and they actually negotiated to a price to make the thing go away.
Dan, can you do the rest of the episode though in that voice?
No. Nobody wins when that happened.
That was great. Like, you people sit back, you hear that. It's like, yeah, I know what that feels like.
Yeah.
In terms of negotiating for a used car. If you had to sit there and negotiate for ransomware. Anyways, Eric, I want to hear your thoughts and perspective on this.
Yeah, well, so I was going to underline it with a reminder to anybody listening that number one, these views are sometimes our own and sometimes not even our own views, right? This is, we're exploring the topic here. I feel like you've got to ask the question, if we continue negotiated paying upfront, if we continue to pay these organizations, are you continuing to give them a reason to exist because they are making money. The article that you sent over, Brian, this morning, I believe it was that article, was talking about one of the groups and how much money they had made. And they have targets. They have earnings targets of getting to $1 billion and $2 billion. These are organizations. And if we continue to pay them, their product's working. We are their product and they're getting money for it.
And phenomenal customer service as a result of it.
Yes.
I'd argue
better than some of the software platforms that we actually pay for. It's crazy.
And just for the record, they're not talking about anybody on this cast in terms of bad product service.
My personal product is a little sketchy at times, but
Eric, you're absolutely right. That's why I wanted to share it too. And coming up, I want to say end of November, middle of November, I'm actually going to have the opportunity to speak with a security head from an insurance company in terms of on the whole person. What's that?
Just his head or the whole person?
It depends.
Like, is it somebody from academia?
It's going to be a video conference, maybe Zoom chat. but we get to have a conversation. I love the fact that we're having this discussion today. Because this idea was brought up almost 2 weeks ago of let's pivot and have the conversation with the insurance company as an open discussion. Because we've done the back and forth from the standpoint of the enterprises. And a lot of people like to point the finger back at the insurance companies. I'll tell you this, from what I've gathered over the last 2 weeks leading up to this discussion, the insurance companies are having a serious look at how these policies are going to be written going forward. How much they have to budget going forward into the 2021-22, right? Because insurance companies are still a business and they're seeing a huge risk, right? And it doesn't matter. I shouldn't say it doesn't matter. They're looking at the different tools that people are using as well and saying, okay, there are some serious fundamental risk that we see coming because there's good analytics now because of the amount of data they have to say companies that are doing X, Y, and Z seem to be extremely more vulnerable than companies that are doing this, right? And I'm not just talking about products. It's about security posture, all these different things. And they're looking at this now because they have to build up their business models and they have a lot of guys that can run numbers, right? That's what they do. They crunch, 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 crunch. And they're saying something needs to happen. Something needs to change.
Talking about the insurance companies, I'm going to throw this back at you, Dan, because you made the comment about calling your insurance company. That's the first thing you're doing. Is cyber insurance though, like your home insurance, right? Anybody who owns a home knows, all right, I got to have home insurance. There's no way around it. But the general conception is I don't want to make a claim because if I make a claim, it's going to cost me more in the long run. So are you not calling?
I think there's a different, the answer is evolving up until
I thought this was going to be, it depends.
That was a variation on it depends. Up until the last 12 to 18 months, the answer was call, 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 call. I've got it. There aren't many exclusions. We're not seeing renewal rates yet start to rise. We're not seeing that same trend. We hadn't been seeing the same trend in how insurance was being priced. It was still being priced as a neophyte product, as a loss leader. And it wasn't mandatory, but the people that had it used it. And it cost the insurance companies a lot of money because as things were starting to come up. The interesting part though is now we're seeing vendor agreements that say, do you have cybersecurity insurance? Tick the box, yes or no. If no, you need to, we either won't do business or you need to prove that you have an independent cash reserve to account for it. As a consultant, I'm often being asked to carry cybersecurity insurance. And so it's becoming more like home insurance, and the value of being able to get it is greater than the value of being able to use it. Right. And which is just like homeowners insurance. If I can't get homeowners insurance, I can't buy a house. I can't have a mortgage on a house. These are required items. It could be crappy homeowners insurance. It could be crappy cybersecurity.
Check the box.
But the other thing is that in this day and age of media, if a tree falls on my roof, and I hear it, the, you know, the, there's a chance that the whole world won't find out about it on CyberScoop. If I have a breach and the ransomware attackers publish it, you will hear about it. The world will hear about it, as will your insurance company. So even if you didn't call them, they're going to know. And that posture will come up at the next review.
It's also worth the tree thing.
Be careful there. The insurance companies were actually trying to pass a law specific around tree insurance so that you would have to have a separate insurance for trees. Because if your tree falls on your own house, you would be covered. But if your neighbor's tree falls on your
house, yeah,
you are not covered, and theirs doesn't cover you either, along with your car, anything in the road, in your driveway, et cetera. And a friend of mine,
neighbor's attacker attacks me too,
was telling me this, and I have this giant tree over here, and I'm like, oh, that is just a major issue for us.
This is uninsured tree insurance, like uninsured motorist.
It's kind of like on the cyber side that they started deeming things act of war, right? And that got them out of it. But I will say, so playing the other side to my question, if you are looking for cyber insurance, there's a lot of good insurers out there that offer a lot of services around it. There's a lot in offering and being proactive. They'll do security assessments. They'll come in, kind of help you build some frameworks, help things shore things up. There can be a lot of good that comes with the premiums you're paying.
It ties together what you were saying, Dan, and also the point that you were making, Eric. Does it become like home insurance? And it is becoming like that, because there's a very, very large automotive company out there that I sat down to talk with maybe 8-9 months ago, whose suppliers were having several issues in terms of cyber attacks, ransomware. And in the open discussion I was having with my friend, he said to me, he goes, well, the first thing we're doing is requiring that all the suppliers now have cyber insurance. And I said, okay, but cyber insurance isn't a silver bullet. He goes, yeah, but it will protect us to make sure none of our real small suppliers go under. The last thing we can have is someone get hit and it hurts the supply chain, and it also helps them get going quickly. We need them back up and going. I go, that's not necessarily what cyber insurance does. Right. I want to make sure you have the right, if you guys are looking at this from a supplier risk standpoint, then you should be going in and adding cyber as part of your investigation when you look at quality, production control, your Kanban system, et cetera. But to say that, do you have cyber insurance as your check the box, that's not protecting you. You're still going to get shut down as the OE when that supplier gets hit.
Yeah.
The cyber insurer doesn't come in and say, yep, I cleaned everything up for you. They help. They bring in tools. They bring in companies that do that. But it's not improving your security posture.
Right. No, and the time to recover from security incident from security incidents is not actually going down as the things are, you know, as the breadth of them grows, as the volume of them grow, it is not easy to completely eradicate and deem something fit for business again. There's definitely work. It doesn't happen overnight.
On the automotive side and the different suppliers, don't quote me on this, but I believe it's now possible on your insurance policy that you can get third-party insurance, that you can get a certain sum of money to protect against the failing of another company in your ecosystem.
Oh, yes. That is definitely that's
and it might be costly. It might be easier, because if you think about it at that point, yes, you're paying the premiums, but you have control over the constraints on when that pays out.
Yeah.
My biggest concern, if you were to start requiring cyber insurance of other third parties, what does that actually mean? There's still a lot of variation between the different policies that get written for different companies. And Brian, kind of to your point, how do you know it's actually going to pay out? You may have just forced them to pay some money, and we might have checked the box that yes, they do have cyber insurance, but it may not be worth the paper that is written on.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And the manner in which that policy gets executed, meaning to what's the event that caused them to have to use the policy, and then the manner in which they engage the insurance company and in what order. So I wasn't joking when I said your first call is to your insurance company. Because I've seen cases where the insurance company will say, we will be your middle person. If you want us to pay out, we want to be the one who brokers with the attorneys, with the IR firms, with the you know, and with law enforcement.
And you got to remember too, if you're a publicly traded company here in America, and you get hit with ransomware,
America,
everybody is, I mean, it's like you report up and then they got to start making decisions. Okay, who are we calling first? It's typically the lawyers, then the insurance companies, FBI.
Your internal lawyers are your first call.
Yeah.
I think
everybody holds that in secrecy up until like
a moment of disclosure.
Right. A lot of these companies that get hit too, when I say hit with ransomware or a breach, et cetera, the public's finding out about it because the people that are going through fingerprinting and going through the code that's sitting there in the dark web is able to pull data that's been exfiltrated, has your company's name in there along with whatever ransomware, you know, has attached their name in some signature or file, right? And then they're reporting that we think this just happened. And lo and behold, all of a sudden someone's like, yes, that's true. All of our computers are down. There was an incident that we are investigating, and they leave it at that, right? Because when you're a publicly traded company, if you were to just come out and report like, oh, we just got hit, every single server's down, we just lost half our data, your stock price could plummet overnight.
But then the question is that a duty you hold to shareholders to inform them as and when something happens?
But you can also play naive, like, well, we're not sure how bad it was, right? Because these people can't go and look. It's not like, hey, we just heard a bomb went off over here, and you open up your window and you can see thousands of miles away a mushroom cloud going up in the air. People can't see this stuff. So when you say we're investigating, we don't know how bad it really is. Or, you know, there was an incident, but we don't think anything's been exfiltrated. Until someone reports it, you can almost play dumb.
We have no reason to believe, except our reservation system is down and you can't make a phone call into us. And
That's tough, because as you start getting into public companies, there's two components. The privacy side of it, and it doesn't matter if you're private or public, right? That there, depending on the states that you're operating on, there are rules that if you know certain amounts of data, I've gotten out certain pieces of data, these things go into action, this is what you must do. On the public side, though, I feel like there's going to be more and more scrutiny for companies to file, and I believe it's an 8K when these things happen. That there were 10K. Major...
It's a 10K, I think.
Well, 10K is a governance document you have to put out every year.
Right.
So 8K, I believe, is any changes since then. So it's there was some major event that could cause a major impact to financials, to the company well-being, to anything. So that's the disclosure don't quote me on this, because I couldn't remember if it was like an 8K or 8Q or not necessarily my forte, but
no, you're
still
right.
Have to file some of those things.
The 8K is the unscheduled material events or corporate changes document from the SEC.
And I think with the more and more government scrutiny on these filings and shareholders willing to take companies to court for not being transparent in their operations, I think it's going to start forcing the hand of a lot of public companies that when these events happen, that you're going to have to pull the trigger on that 8K pretty quickly to let shareholders know, hey, something's going on.
So I got final thoughts for you. Okay. We talked about ransomware. We talked about the idea of insurance. We talked about what you were just reporting on, the idea of things that public companies would have to file, and also the worry around share price. But let's say that the threat actor was using a tool or a device that was built by your government, and by accident, they let it out of the pen, right? So they had this wild animal caged up that they biologically changed. It had five heads. It was this mammoth lion, and it gets out and kills 10 people. Who's responsible? And what I'm talking about is something called WannaCry. And for those that are listening, WannaCry was supposedly stolen from a stash out of the NSA, got out there, was changed, manipulated a little
back
bit.
To shadow but brokers.
But it was this lion with a multi-head beast. You know, it's Halloween, guys. Think fangs and just foam at the mouth. And it came and it just ravaged companies. And at the end of the day, though, a lot of people didn't know. I think even right now, some of the people listening are probably like, what's this guy talking about? That was actually a tool, one of the tools from the kit of one of our US organizations. They built it and it got loose and then it came back and hurt you. Like, your dog gets out and bites me. Are you liable?
It's an interesting thought.
I think if it weren't government, the answer is much clearer. There's still this myth. There's still myths around being able to sue the government, being able to exact revenge on, you know, on a government agency in the U.S. I actually don't know. I think you can, you know, you of course can file the suit. The question was, what is, you know, what's the end game? Is it just to go, I told you that they were at fault? And I don't know what that buys you, but
I don't know. I don't know if you'd have any grounds to stand on anyways. Because I'm not aware of any legislation that anybody has the onus is on them to disclose anything they find. That's why we've gotten to this whole concept of responsible disclosure that says, me as a security practitioner, I find something that the responsible act on my part is to contact the company silently, let them know, give them an opportunity to fix it. And if they don't, then I'm going to go public with it and force their hand. But from a legal perspective, I don't think there's anything that forces disclosure of any bugs.
So then, Eric, let me change the narrative then. Brian Schneebly's in his basement. Or actually, let's not use Brian. I'm not that crafty. But some other gentleman in a blue shirt is in his basement, and I build a super worm with multi-head, few different 0 days. And I don't sell it to anybody, but I don't really protect my computer. Someone comes in, they steal it, and it goes out there and wreaks havoc, right? They come back and they're like, dude, Brian, or not Brian, this other guy that we know in his
base. This other guy that might look like Brian, might wear the same colored shirt as Brian, but it's definitely not Brian.
Not Brian. Built this crazy worm, this.
You're getting back to the story. I'm guessing you're malware tech and Marcus Hutchins.
Ah, yes.
Yes. And I was trying to remember the name, but I read the story, had this banter back and forth with a colleague. And I also have read another story about someone that actually didn't even know he was building something bad for somebody. He thought he was helping somebody out with a project. And lo and behold, he built a remarkable tool that was used for ransomware for like 2.5 years.
Yeah.
And they came back and held him liable.
Yeah,
this is an age-old debate, though, in the legal system that can be applied to so many different topics on where a tool could be used for good, could be used for research, or it could be used for bad, right? And who's actually responsible when somebody, pun intended, pulls the trigger on the bad aspects of it? Who's responsible? Is it the person that is this holding the weapon, the exploit, the hitting enter to run the code, or is it the person that actually wrote it in the beginning?
So Eric, if we lose a nuclear missile, somebody's head rolls. Somebody gets in trouble. You lose a worm called WannaCry that did far more damage. And it was kind of like, it's kind of interesting that we have this group that makes this really cool stuff. That's neat. Good to know. Nobody's head rolled.
But if we're to take this example and pull it all the way through, then what we would say is that Sir Tim Berners-Lee should be charged with creation of the internet for facilitating it all in the first place. And with that, we've run out of time for today. Thank you, Brian and Eric. Yet another very interesting discussion. These are just great ways to have to look at topics from 360 degrees. And if you're listening, we'd love to get your feedback. Please find us on Twitter at Security Debate, at our website, www.greatsecuritydebate.net, and email feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net. We want your thoughts, your ideas, your feedback, your show ideas, your critiques, everything we can to do to make the show better, short of arresting Tim Berners-Lee for creating the internet in the first place. And thank you, and we will see you again next time for another great security debate.